Welcome on to our continuing season preview series here on the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Today we are doing the Philadelphia 76ers, and we are lucky to have Derek Bodner of Philly Mag, Draft Express, and USA Today joining us right now. Derek, what's up?
Not much. How you doing?
Real good, real good. So this has been an interesting team to cover over the last couple of years in a front office sense, perhaps less interesting on the court. But tell us about this team last year, you know, kind of how they got to this record. Obviously, you know, I think a lot of people, including me, frankly, I didn't watch as much of them as I probably should have just because they were out of it from the beginning. And even, you know, they really only had one or two guys that had any kind of a name to them that you thought of as being a part of this next great Sixers team. But surprisingly, they actually played amazing defense last year for the talent that was on the roster.
Yeah, no, I mean, their defense improved substantially last year from, I want to say, mid to late 20s. I want to say like 26th in defensive rating to 13th. And a lot of that goes to, you know, a lot of that credit goes to Nerlens Noel. He has that kind of an impact. And actually, if you look at his on-off splits, the Sixers defense looks surprisingly like the Sixers defense of 2013 and 14 when Noel was on the bench. So just having that one difference maker, and not only a difference maker, but a guy who's as versatile as Noel, really went a long way in their improvement. You know, it helps the Sixers' strategy up until this point. You know, they were largely looking for undervalued assets, and a lot of those undervalued assets are guys with incredible athletic tools and athletic potential who might not be fully developed as basketball players. So they drafted a lot of guys like Jeremy Grant, guys like KJ McDaniels, Michael Carter-Williams, hoping that, you know, they could teach them the game of basketball. They could teach them how to shoot. They could rein in some of that athleticism. So it makes a little bit of sense that they would be further along on the defensive side of the court because they did target those kind of athletes. So that helped a lot. But a lot of it was Nerlens Noel. And a lot of that's, you know, really the reason why some fans in Philadelphia have, I don't want to say unbridled optimism about the team. You know, but he's a big part of any optimism that does exist. He is certainly a guy who I expect to be in the running for a Defensive Player of the Year award throughout his career. He is that unique, really the new age big man, the guy who can alter shots at the rim, but also who can blow up on the perimeter, defend pick and rolls, force steals, and get you out in transition. So it's going to be fun to watch him develop in his second season. He was, you know, a guy who, when you looked at his contributions, especially on the offensive end from, you know, the first third of the season, and then you look at him towards the end of the year, he made huge strides. So he will be a big part of this next year and hopefully a big part of their future.
So if they were defending kind of at the same level they had the previous year without him on the court, then when he was out there, they must have been like a solidly a top 10 defense.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have the exact numbers, but they were definitely in the top 10. I want to say probably somewhere in the sixth rate range. I mean, they were really locked in when he was in there. He made a huge difference. Obviously shots at the rim were much, much better contested. But just in all aspects, including, like I said, forcing turnovers was a really big part as well, especially, you know, for a team that struggled in the half court and struggled, is putting it mildly, getting those transition opportunities and getting out there and getting easy buckets and easy points was huge.
Well, yeah, especially when you consider that they're basically never scoring, and that obviously, when you score, that really helps your defense. The fact that they ranked as highly as they did has to be impressive. And I think the other thing that's impressive too is, granted, Noel has a ton of talent, but when's the last time a rookie big man was actually good defensively? And just getting a young team to defend and execute the scheme, no matter how much athleticism you have, is a credit to the coaching staff.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, I think it was Kevin Pelton of ESPN mentioned this the other day, that he had the highest defensive BPM of any big man since, I think it was, Tim Duncan. So you're going back, like you said, rookie big men just do not make that kind of a defensive impact. And like you said, huge credit to Brett Brown. I think, you know, having that, basically that red shirt rookie season probably helped him learn, you know, what Brown expected, what kind of defensive principles they were looking to instill, and really helped, you know, that transition to the NBA a little bit. But certainly, I mean, Brett Brown, huge credit. Nerlens Noel, huge credit as well.
How would you characterize their defense from a scheme standpoint?
I mean, they blitz a lot of pick and rolls. Like I said, turnovers and transition is a big part of what they do. So they're looking to really trap ball handlers and force mistakes. And obviously they have a very Houston Rockets style to everything they do. So they're going to jump out and contest three-pointers. They're going to, you know, give you that mid-range shot and let you take that if need be. But just a lot of blitz and roll, blitzing the pick and roll and trying to really trap ball handlers and force turnovers.
On the other end, of course, it was a disaster. I forget who it was who ran this chart recently, but relative to league average, they, I think, were one of the five worst offenses this century.
Yeah.
I mean, were there any bright spots offensively for this team last year?
Yeah, I mean, not a whole lot. I think they were last in the league in free throw percentage. They were second last in the league in three-point percentage. They led the league in turnovers. There was not a lot, and especially when you can find them in the half court. Michael Carter Williams did a lot in the open court and really helped their transition offense. He had his holes in the half court. Nerlens Noel, I would say, was probably a positive. I mean, you just saw a guy when he got out there to start the season last year. He looked like, you know, a fawn learning how to run. He had all of this athleticism and all of this bounce, and he had absolutely no idea how to use any of it. The game seemed like it really slowed down for him in the second half of the season. And he took better shots, and he was able to drive to the hoop a little bit. And he made his free throws. I think he ended up the season shooting about 60% from the free throw line, which if you would have, you know, looked at him at Kentucky, I mean, this was a guy who legitimately didn't attempt a single jump shot at Kentucky. He was never really asked to do that either in high school or in college. And he was shooting in the low 50s in free throw percentage. So for him to make that substantial of a jump, and we're talking about a decent amount of attempts. I think it was about, you know, just under 250 attempts. So there was some hope that his free throw, and hopefully that then extends the game situation, could be improved. So he was really the, you know, what you would look at as the positive. Robert Covington was a huge find. For him to shoot the volume of three-point shots that he took, which was, I think he was in the top 10 in attempts, and he didn't get very many open looks. I mean, they just didn't have anybody who could create off the dribble. They didn't have any post scores. He didn't really have anyone to operate in the pick and roll. So there was no reason to ever leave Robert Covington. And for him to shoot 37% on that volume, you know, I think I looked at it in transition. He was shooting in the low 40s on transition threes. And it seemed like that was the only real way he could get an open look. So I think if you look at him with adding a guy like Okafor and his post presence, you know, he might have a little more that he could give. That 37% might be 39 or 40% if you can just get him some open looks. So I think a huge, huge plus as well.
Do you think Covington could be good enough to be like a real high-quality 3-and-D starter like on a playoff team someday?
Yeah, I think he can.
Does he have that type of upside?
I think on the right team with the right people around him, he can be a starter. I mean, his shot is very pure. It's a very quick shot. He gets good elevation. He can get it off with, you know, really little room. And that, to me, is almost as important as anything with a three-point shot. You know, when you're talking about, you know, gravity and spacing, that threat to be able to get it off quickly is huge. And he does that, and he does that well, and he does that well with a hand in his face. I think he's the guy with how important the three-point shot has become in today's NBA. And he does enough. You know, he's not a great defender right now. He can certainly get lost at times. His lateral speed is not necessarily good enough to, you know, some of the hyper athletes that he's going to face on the perimeter, he's not going to be able to keep up with. But he has quick hands. He gets his, you know, he forces turnovers. And for the most part, he gives effort, and he's a decent enough athlete on the perimeter. So, yeah, I think on the right team, and I think that's probably key, but on the right team with the way the NBA is going, I think he can be a starter in the right situation.
They traded for Isaiah Cannon. Is it Cannon, or is that how you pronounce his last name, right?
Actually, Cannon. He goes by Cannon.
Cannon.
I pronounced it Cannon for about a month before it sunk into my head that he is not Cannon.
Too much Bible study, right?
Yeah. He does have probably the most biblical name in the league. I mean, it has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Too much Hebrew school for me to say Cannon. But so they trade away KJ McDaniels for him. KJ. I think the reason that they traded him was because they felt like, you know, he had signed the required tender. He was going to be a restricted free agent at the end of the year. Kanan kind of played well in some areas that people didn't realize. I mean, I think people thought, oh, the Sixers team can't shoot, but with Covington, and then with him, I saw the stat the other day that he was the only guy in the league to shoot a higher percentage on pull-up threes off the dribble than Steph Curry did. Did he open up the offense at all? And I asked this legitimately because I didn't watch that much over the last, you know, after the trade deadline for that team. Did he open up the offense, or is that impact maybe overstated a little bit?
Well, he certainly, I mean, he can shoot the ball. I mean, he's that's one very legitimate NBA skill that he has, and he does it at a high level. And like you said, off the dribble, pulling up from deep, pulling up quickly, he has very good accuracy. It's really the one skill he can bank, because the rest of his game was really deficient. He does not beat anybody off the dribble. I've never really seen a guard in the NBA who probably creates less than he does. I mean, he just doesn't have the speed to get by anybody, and it comes into play on the defensive end as well. He has pretty big deficiencies. But I think with Okafor and, you know, what you hope Okafor will be and how much of your offense you want to run through him and how much spacing is going to be key for him, then I do think he probably makes a team and has a role, because that shooting, I mean, he's an elite shooter. It's just he really has nothing else around him.
Of the guys who are on this team right now, and we'll talk about some of the new additions too, but who do you see as someone who you think could legitimately be a good rotation player on like a real NBA team of the guys who are on the roster right now?
Well, I mean, we, you know, obviously the guys that we talked about, the Noel, Okafor, Covington, I think Kendall Marshall's a legitimate backup point guard. He's another one who, I mean, a lot of times we look at transition play and we think of guys sprinting up and down the court. Kendall Marshall obviously isn't that, but he's very good with the ball in his hands. He pushes the ball in transition and gets the ball to guys in the right spots who can, you know, let their athletic gifts take over for them. His three-point shot has improved. He's obviously a big question mark defensively, and even more so coming off of the torn ACL. But I think he's a backup in this league. So you have those four guys. I think Jeremy Grant, he's a rotation player on the team. Maybe not now. Maybe, you know, if you traded him like you did KJ McDaniels to a contender, he wouldn't get time. But I do think that, you know, when he develops and matures and his game rounds out, I mean, this was a guy, I think he made about 6 threes in college. So for them to, again, make the kind of progress they made developing that shot, and he was really streaky last year, but, you know, he made some progress. I think he's going to work his way into being a rotation guy. And I think Hollis Thompson has a spot in a rotation, too. He's another guy that he can kind of get lost a little bit in that he doesn't do enough outside of his shooting to really make an impact all the time. He's an average defender, but not a great defender. He doesn't do much with the ball in his hands, but he's another one. That shooting is very legitimate. So I think he's probably a rotation guy as well. And honestly, I could see Christian Wood being a rotation guy as well, but that's all going to come down to him, his work ethic, his maturity, his coachability, all those question marks that, you know, when you were following him in the draft process became very big question marks to the point where he wasn't drafted. I mean, that was a fall that was unlike most you will see. I mean,
that was remarkable with the physical tools that he has.
And you go back to the I mean, I know at Draft Express, we had him in the first round as late as June. You know, we're talking weeks before the draft. I know ESPN, Chad Ford, had him in the first round in June. I'm pretty sure NBC Sports and I know at USA Today, I had him in the first round in June, and he just dropped. I mean, it was, you did not find very many people who had positive things to say about him from a maturity standpoint, but by the same token, you just don't see 6'11 guys with that kind of athleticism who can shoot, block shots, you know, pump fake and drive to the basket like he can. I mean, there's so many tools for him to work with. If his head is on right, then I think he's a rotation player as well. And obviously Joel Embiid if he ever gets healthy.
Yeah, that's another one. So now there are a bunch of guys that you didn't mention. I mean, obviously a lot of this Sixers strategy is just, let's take as many flyers as we can and hope that they work out. So I'm going to give you maybe 5 names of other guys on the roster. You tell me who you think is the most likely to really work out into being a player. Nick Stauskas.
Yeah.
Rashawn Holmes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Rashawn Holmes. All right. Well, actually, it's probably better to just do it that way. I'll give you some names, and you just tell me kind of what you think about their ability to become a good NBA player. Because, of course, that's still always what this is all about in Philly. Really, it doesn't matter that much how well the team plays this year. So what about Stauskas? Why don't we start there?
Yeah, I think, and he kind of slipped my mind because he hasn't played in preseason yet. But, yeah, he certainly has NBA talent. I mean, he was drafted 8th overall for a reason. Guys who can shoot, but also who can create a little bit out of the pick and roll and have a little bit of athleticism, I mean, they're going to find roles in this league. It's just whether or not, you know, he can make that transition. You know, I think a lot of times we look at prospects coming in and we look at athletes having a tough transition to make, but skilled guys having maybe an easier transition and guys who should be able to contribute right away. And I don't think that's necessarily fair. You know, I think especially for shooters, playing against guys with the length of NBA defenders who can cover the ground that NBA defenders can, not to mention learning, you know, a new coach, a new system, getting used to playing as frequently as NBA guys do, training as hard as NBA guys do. I think there's a pretty big transition there. So I think for a guy like Stauskas, he's certainly an NBA player to me. I mean, he's got a world of skills. And like I said, for a lot of shooters, he's not as one trick as I think a lot of people assume he is.
Yeah, I think that's right. And since you do draft stuff, I think that you're maybe remember the reasons to believe in him, you know, rather than just him getting lit up by Klay Thompson for 37 points as like being the highlight of his rookie year. To me, I think, though, it's not like there's a ton of shooting guard talent on this team. I think it would be a little bit of a disappointment if he does not seize that starting shooting guard spot once he's healthy. What is your kind of taking the temperature? What do you think the likelihood of that is?
Yeah, I think there's a very high likelihood. I mean, even if maybe it's not the right move to win games day one, that's clearly not the Sixers' goal or objective right now. I mean, they're going to want to put him out there, not only to develop him and form some chemistry between him and Okafor and Noel and the other guys on the team, but also to evaluate him and see what they have in him and put him, you know, in all kinds of situations. And I think a lot of times with teams and prospects, they tend to put guys in situations where they can succeed. And I think the Sixers have a little bit of a different approach to that. They want to put him out there and get information and see how he reacts, give him opportunity that you maybe wouldn't have. And like I said with Noel, you know, I think what they're hoping is that they will learn from those experiences and grow as players, where Noel just looked completely out of place to start the season, and giving the ball more and more frequently in different spots, and probably any team in the league would have given it to him in, especially in the first half when he was so inefficient and so, you know, struggling.
Yeah, I mean, he was taking jump shots that just looked like ridiculous, you know, I mean, and you're just like, this has no chance. Like, why is he taking these? I mean, I think like throughout most of the year, like his true shooting percentage was like well below 500 for a guy who should just be dunking on people. Right. Like, you would think that that's his role.
Right. And 4 years down the line, you know, he might just be a pick and roll garbage finisher, and he might play a more natural role that you would expect. But right now they want to give him every opportunity to, you know, all those skills that he's practicing in practice, they're going to let him do in the game. I think with Stauskas, you're going to see some of that as well. They're going to give him minutes and a green light, and they're going to see, you know, like I said, both to evaluate him and to hopefully develop him.
How about Tony Roten? Quickly on him. He's coming back from the torn ACL. Is he someone who you think could potentially be an NBA rotation player someday?
Yeah, probably. I mean, he's certainly has the talent and the athleticism. I mean, you're not going to find many 6'5" guys at the point guard spot who can, you know, have the speed and the quickness and the leaping ability that he does. He can certainly get to the rim, which is, it's kind of amazing that he can do so because he really only has, you know, a left hand. He doesn't have anything going to his right. So for him to be able to get to the rim as consistently as he does, despite that limitation, is pretty incredible and says something about his, you know, his natural talent. And Brett Brown will be quick to remind you that he is, of the Sixers point guards, I believe he's actually the youngest on the roster still, despite the fact that, you know, he's coming into his fourth year in the league. So certainly there's stuff to work with. I mean, he has a lot. To me, in order to really be a contributor, a regular contributor on a championship-level team, he has a lot of holes to fix. That jump shot is first and foremost. He just doesn't – I mean, people – defenders don't respect it at all, and for very good reason. Outside of 3 feet, I think his shooting percentage outside of 3 feet was in the 30s. It might even be lower than
that's
that.
Bad.
I mean, it was really bad. And his turnovers. And not only turnovers, but live ball turnovers. And that's one of the things when we were talking about the Sixers' defensive improvement. They turned the ball over a lot, and they gave up a lot of transition points because of that. And Tony Roten had a hand in that. He makes some passes that just leave you scratching your head. You know, part of the reason he's able to get to the rim as consistently as he does is because he throws caution to the wind at every opportunity. And right now that's fine, but I think he's going to have to develop and really improve both his three-point shooting and his decision-making to really be a contributor on a championship-level team.
And that assumes even that he comes back the same athletically from the ACL as well. How about Rashawn Holmes, who's out of Bowling Green?
Yeah.
Is that right? Yes, a 6'11 power forward who can shoot the ball a little bit, block some shots. What do you think of him?
You know what? He was a guy, I was out there at Portsmouth heading up to the draft, and I'll be quite honest, I didn't watch a whole lot of Bowling Green throughout the year. Guilty as charged. But he was one of those guys that just completely stood out. He looked like a man among boys at Portsmouth. So I went back, I watched him Bowling Green, then I went and saw him at the Combine, and again, he was just blowing people away. And I mean, this is a kid, when you talk about the modern NBA power forward, you're looking for guys who can block shots, hit the defensive glass, and stretch the floor. And he does a little bit of all of those. You know, he's Defensive Player of the Year, three-point range. He just has a lot of tools, and he seems like a good kid who works hard, has a good NBA body, long arms, strong. He can hold his own down low. He certainly, to me, is a guy, and again, it's tough for second-round picks coming in, you know, haven't played in the league yet. He's not a guy that I look at as any threat to be cut from the Sixers. He's a guy that I think, you know, is going to get some pretty significant time. And I do think, you know, he has a chance to be a contributor down the line. He is definitely a guy who I would throw into that mix as a, you know, a contributor on good teams. I think he can be that kind of a role. I think that kind of a big man is very important in this league.
Yeah, I mean, if you can shoot threes, rebound, and block some shots, there's absolutely a role for you in the NBA. Even, you know, I don't see him as a guy who's ever going to create one-on-one. I don't know that he's like an amazing, like, pick-and-roll finisher necessarily. He seems like kind of more of a straight-up-and-down guy than a guy who's going to be, like, attacking the rim. But, yeah, I mean, I was very impressed by him. I just saw only about a three-quarters of a game of him live before I was at the game where he fractured his elbow in Utah. And I was really impressed with what he was able to do in that game. And the last guy, Furkan Aldemir, is someone who I think, you know, had some pretty good statistical translations coming from Europe. I've never really been able to see what skill he has other than offensive rebounding. Am I selling him short?
No, that's pretty much it. He sets a mean screen too. But those are really the two things that he brings. I mean, he's a guy that over in Europe, he was a huge pick and roll guy. He just set a hard screen, dove to the basket. He could finish in that league. He doesn't have the athleticism to really do that in the NBA. He's going to get, you know, it's not going to be an efficient form of offense, so he's had to adapt. And right now, the way he's adapted is that he pretty much just doesn't do anything on the offensive side of the court. He offensive rebounds and he passes the ball and that's it. He's tried to add in practice, you know, a 3-point shot and a baseline jump shot. He hasn't really busted that out yet in games outside of, you know, he had one game in the summer league where I think he hit three threes, but outside of that, that hasn't shown up yet. I mean, he's a guy whose primary contributions right now are on the offensive glass, and you hope that he can add something else to that. I will say he's gotten in better shape than he was last year. I think when he got over here last year, he was not in the kind of shape that Brett Brown of the Sixers would want him to be, and he seems like he's corrected that. So I think they're probably going to give him a roster spot and let him try to, you know, prove his worth and prove that he can adjust and play against this level of competition and athleticism. But right now, I think he's just overmatched.
All right. Well, we haven't even talked very much about Jahlil Okafor. You know, I think everyone kind of is familiar with the scouting report on him coming out of Duke. Great score, supposedly a horrible defensive player. Based on what you've seen in summer league and now in the preseason, what is your forecast for what he'll be able to do this year?
I mean, that is going to be a fascinating thing to watch. I mean, I think, you know, we just talked about this earlier. There's such an adjustment for rookies in, you know, coming into the NBA. And it's sometimes tough. I mean, you can go back and look at Wiggins last year, and the debate still goes on about, you know, the 538 article about whether or not and he was basically the worst player in the NBA at one point, or he cost his team the most wins, or I forget what the exact premise was, but it was pointing out how bad he was. And then he went on and went on that tear in the second half of the season. It's a very tough transition, and it's a transition we haven't really seen post players make a whole lot recently, especially from the NBA. You've seen it almost more from Europe than you have from college basketball. So it'll be interesting to watch. You know, I do think he's going to have a pretty big adjustment period. You can see when he went up against Gortat against the Wizards, he's just not used to banging against guys who are his equal. And a lot of times in college, you would see him kind of start in the high post and then work his way down closer to the basket. And I think he's finding that that's a little bit harder to do in the NBA. So I think they're going to make, you know, getting that initial post position deeper a really big priority. Brett Brown talked about doing a lot of what Orlando did with Dwight Howard back in the day, where they would pick and roll him into a post-up, using that to try to get him better positioning. Brett Brown is focusing a lot on rim running and running the break, not necessarily to get transition opportunities, but to get him posted up early in the shot clock. You know, I think that...
Yeah, I noticed that in that Washington game, he just sprinted the floor, and it seemed like also, I haven't heard that this is true, but maybe you can speak to it, that it seemed like they're just intentionally playing him in shorter stints so that he can kind of learn how hard he has to be playing on a play-by-play basis, and then if he gets tired, you just take him out and bring him back in when he's ready again. Is that kind of what the strategy is?
No, I mean, from the get-go, Brett was talking about, you know, five-minute stints with him. They're looking to get him into four to five-minute stints, keep his minutes about, you know, 20 minutes per game to start, and then work him into shape. And, you know, right now...
I love that strategy,
by the way. Well, and right now, their biggest thing, almost more than how he's playing, is that he's running at full tilt. Because a lot of times in college, and I think that the 35-second shot clock, which they're dropping down to 30 now this year, but I think the 35-second shot clock kind of allows, I don't want to say lazy habits, but getting up there and getting set in your offense early isn't as much of a priority. So you have that more time, and especially for a post guy like Okafor, who needs time to get the ball, who needs time to survey a defense and react to the double teams, getting into the shot clock, getting into position early is going to be big for him. So I think that's going to be a bit of an adjustment. I think there's going to be some struggles for him this year. I think you're probably looking, if I had to put a number on it, you know, probably 15 to 16 and 8, probably somewhere in that range. Probably not on the efficiency that you would want from a big man. You know, but hopefully he learns how to navigate, you know, these NBA defenders and these NBA double teams, which, you know, are going to come a little harder, a little quicker than they did in college.
Yeah, I thought that Washington game was really instructive in a number of ways. One, everyone was like on Twitter, oh yeah, like he's dominating, but he was taking some terrible shots. You know, we're talking like that cannot be. I mean, he's got a great touch. You know, like that's a preternatural touch, you might even say, out to maybe like 12 feet or so. But the type of shots he was taking, contested step backs, like that cannot be the foundation of an efficient offensive game. And I think he's really going to have to change the way he plays. I think that getting him to play with more effort is huge. But he also, for a guy his size, he doesn't really, in college, he didn't really have any power moves. It was all kind of spin moves. You know, he's not getting his shoulder into people and protecting the ball, getting fouled. Like, his free throw rate was actually lower than you might have thought for a guy who's posting up all the time and had his type of size. He's much more kind of into, like, the sort of balletic post moves, rather than really just some power moves. And I think that with his body, I mean, with 270 pounds, he's got the strength advantage even on a lot of NBA centers. That's what he's going to have to focus on so he can get some more cheap, efficient points, because everything being contested, you're not going to fake guys out in the NBA and just get wide open for a hook shot. Like, those are hard shots that you're pretty much anyone is going to shoot 45% or less on.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think you hit it on the head. I mean, you're talking about a 270-pound guy that you're watching dominate in the post in college and forcing double teams in the post, and you just kind of assume that he's playing a power game. But, I mean, his footwork is so incredible, and he's able to make so many moves and spin moves and counter moves that it really is more of a finesse game. And it's something that he did very well, and something that he's still going to do. I mean, they're still going to, you know, put him at the elbow and let him create a little bit, maybe more than they did at Duke. But he certainly has to get closer and use his strength and size to his advantage. And I think he probably can develop that. It's just going to be an adjustment.
Yeah, and he's going to need the left hand a little bit more, too. Yes. I think, you know, he uses that on occasion, but really, like, when the guy's right next to him and, you know, he doesn't have the explosion. He's got to get that right shoulder into guys when he's on the left side and create some space and finish with the left, because the whole, like, bringing it back into guys with the right hand, that can work for guys who can jump over people, but it's not. I don't think that's really going to work for him
right as
well. I mean, maybe it will. Al Jefferson has never shot a shot with his left hand in his life and has been effective, but he's definitely kind of foreclosing on an area of potential if he doesn't learn that. On the other hand, I thought, you know, after watching a lot of film of him before the draft, that he would not be as bad ultimately defensively as people thought. I thought he had better tools, and especially with the quick feet and pretty quick hands as well, and 7'5 wingspan than people thought. And I've been relatively encouraged with how he's been able to defend so far. What's your thought on that?
I think the general consensus is that he has played better than a lot of people expected. He's always going to give up a lot of ground on the pick and roll, especially when he's playing, you know, the Wizards and John Wall. You're not going to trap with Jahlil Okafor. But he has played the angles well. He has certainly been engaged on that end. His decision-making seems like it's been better than it was at Duke. I think at times with Duke, what really got me, not so much his, you know, he has a tall, he has long arms. He's a big body. What got me was that his decision-making seemed like it was a second slow. There's some hesitation there. And it seems like he's committing more when, you know, blocking shots and playing from the weak side. He's getting into better positioning. So far, I think on the defensive side of the court, it's been most good. And he plays pretty good post defense, and that was true at Duke too. So I think there's reason for optimism there that he might not be. I mean, when you're talking about a guy who is going to be a defensive liability, like most people expected Okafor to be, it just leaves so little room for error on the offensive side of the court. And I think you're saying that you might be able to build a decent enough defense with him at the five, especially when you have a guy like Noel at the four who can, you know, contest shots on the perimeter and play those perimeter fours, but also has the athleticism to get back into plays at the rim and really help out in that regard. So I think I think everybody's a little bit more optimistic about Okafor, you know, after watching him play a little bit in the summer league and now through three preseason games.
Yeah, and he actually even every once in a while will get those kind of Tim Duncan style blocks where he doesn't even leave his feet, and but he's just has the timing to get his hand on the ball. I think he got Marcin Gortat twice like that in the Washington game. But, you know, obviously his preseason offensively, I think, hasn't been that great because he's just been taking tough shots and, you know, getting his shot blocked a little bit too. But, yeah, I think, what is your opinion of the Noel Okafor pairing? I think it works just fine defensively because of Noel's mobility. Offensively, though, you wonder long-term about whether there'll be enough space.
Yeah, and that's the big question mark. It's kind of interesting because they're both good passers. And I think one of the underrated skills for Noel was his passing. He actually, I went back and talked to his AAU coach back in the day, and he played with Georges Nang from Iowa State, and he played, you know, played a lot of high-low with Noel up, you know, around the foul line area, making decisions with the ball, moving the ball. He has some experience in that regard. I think his passing is probably a trait that people overlook. He made some progress in his jump shot, more in free throws than in game situations. I do think, you know, spacing is going to be a huge concern. And with a guy like Okafor, you need him to have that space to operate, to be able to force perimeter defenders to bite down and double team from that. I think you're going to see a lot of Noel on the baseline and keep him close to the hoop so he can cut if his guy doubles off of him to help on Okafor. But, I mean, that's going to be a huge issue, a huge question mark at least, and certainly something that if it does get ultimately resolved, it's probably years away from being fully resolved.
Yeah, and I think Noel's ability to attack off the dribble is something that I was pretty impressed by in towards the end of last year and then in the preseason as well. I mean, he's able to go by guys pretty well. And also, you know, with the number of minutes that you're talking about Okafor playing and big guys, it's a rare big man who's going to play more than 30, 32 minutes, even once they're, you know, kind of fully formed and they're beyond this kind of trial period with Okafor where they're trying to teach him to play hard. So I'm sure that Noel will get plenty of minutes at center still also the idea that they have to play together every second. I mean, maybe they'll only play together, you know, 16 minutes a game or something like that. Right. So let me ask you this. I mean, getting on, we've been talking about the guys and the pieces here, but we should talk about a little bit how this team is likely to play this year. What do you see as kind of some of the key playing time battles on this team going forward?
Well, I mean, the point guard spot is the one that's most up in the air. Obviously, the front court of Okafor and Noel is pretty set in stone, at least as a starting front court. Robert Covington seems like he's got one of the two wing spots locked down pretty well. And like we talked about earlier, there's a huge incentive to play Stauskas and play him pretty big minutes just to see what you have in him and hopefully develop him. So the point guard spot is the key battle. Both Tony Roten and Kendall Marshall are currently out. They're recovering from ACLs. So you're left with Isaiah Cannon and Pierre Jackson, who's also injured, Scotty Wilbekin and TJ McConnell. So quite the collection of point guards they currently have. And the biggest battle right now is who will win that third spot and likely start the season, you know, as a starter. It's probably going to come down to the Cannon because of that shooting ability. But that's probably the biggest and most wide open spot. But I mean, the shooting guard spot as well. There's, you know, you've got Jakar Sampson, who they love, and who has come a long way, who they even used at times as a point guard last year. But another one of those 6'7", 6'8" athletes, that can really defend, and he'll listen to Brown, you know, follow his coaching. His jump shot is still erratic, but at times showing signs of life. And he can, you know, he's one of those guys that looks like he could potentially do a lot of things, except he can't really do it right now. But I think they like him quite a bit, and they want to get him minutes. And you've got you've got Hollis Thompson as well, who's a good role player, probably would be better served on a more veteran team where he would fill a more defined role. But another guy who you can pretty much pencil him in for 40% from 3-point range on a pretty decent chunk of attempts. So that spot's a little wide open as well.
What about at the backup bigs? You know, you've got, maybe you could see Grant or Covington coming in and playing some small ball four. Is that an alignment they might go for?
Yeah, no. They talked about using both of them in that role. I think especially with Covington, it's something that's tempting to do because his shooting would be so valuable for really either Noel, you know, facing up and driving to the basket, or Okafor in the post. So I think you could see that from both of them. You know, I think they like keeping Grant around the hoop because of his athleticism. With both of those guys, you're going to have to, you know, worry about defensive rebounding and really defending the post if you do run into a team that has two post scorers. But yeah, both of them will definitely see pretty considerable time at the four spot. And it really depends what they do with their roster, whether they keep Aldemir, whether they keep Christian Wood, how much playing time those guys are able to command early in the season, and also how much playing time Rashawn Holmes is able to command. So it probably is somewhat dictated by whether or not any of those guys really steps up and earns that playing time. But you'll definitely see both of them playing small ball power forward quite a bit.
Who's your prediction for the guy who will kind of be the third traditional big behind Noel and Okafor?
I think it'll probably end up being Holmes. You know, I think his skill set is so easy to fit with either with either Noel or Okafor, but I could see him, you know, sliding into that spot pretty easily.
Carl Landry was part of that salary dump trade. He's still on the roster. He has still two more years left on his contract, making over $6 million. But he's coming back from wrist surgery. Is obviously an older guy. I think he's 31. Doesn't fit into the Sixers' long term plan. What are they going to do with him? They're going to release him? Is he going to actually play a little bit and they might try and move him or something like that? What's the story there?
Well, I think if they're going to release him, they probably would have done it before preseason. I mean,
that's what I thought too.
He's a guy who he's not going to be ready by it, even really to practice at a, you know, 5-on-5 level until after the season already starts. So I think if they were just going to dump him, then it probably would have happened by now. I don't want to say it surprises me that he's still on the roster, but I thought there was a chance they would have just moved on for all the reasons you just said. But I think they might want to keep him around kind of maybe in that Luke Ba Mute role, that veteran who can, you know, give the younger players a little bit of guidance. And another bigger body that Okafor can kind of bang against, you know, in the post, somebody that could prevent him from getting to his spots and maybe work on him in that regard. I mean, he's a good teammate, a guy who's not going to cause any problems with playing time, and a guy who's going to come in and be a professional about it. So maybe they keep him around just, you know, as that veteran mentor for a lot of these guys.
Yeah, and maybe also the thought, too. Yeah, because he's really the only veteran. They had Jason Richardson last year, too, who was another guy that was lauded as a good influence on this team. So maybe the idea is you keep him around in that role. And then also, if he can actually start playing again, you know, he's not going to have any trade value likely with what he's making, but maybe he could start playing well enough that he could potentially glom on with a contender later in the year, and then you could get a little bit of money off just with a buyout, where he would actually be willing to do that once it's realistic for him to go to another team where he, you know, would be more useful.
Right.
But we'll see. I mean, he's struggled with injuries so much these last 2 years in Sacramento. You know, it's questionable really whether he could even help a team that is trying to go anywhere this year. But maybe he'll do better once he gets back from this wrist surgery.
Yep, no doubt. I mean, if they do keep him to look to flip him later on towards deadline, it's not going to be for, you know, an asset back. You're not trading him for a draft pick or anything like that. If you trade him, I think you're just looking to maybe decrease your financial commitment for next year.
All right, well, what do you see now for playing actual basketball games this year? What is this team going to be good at, and what are their big weaknesses going to be?
That's a great question. I mean, you're taking a team who was historically bad last year offensively, and they should be better. I mean, you add Okafor over Henry Sims, you add Stauskas over, you know, Christopher Johnson was their starting shooting guard opening day last year. You have another full year of Noel developing, another full year with Covington. They should be a better offensive team, but is that good enough to have an offensive identity? I mean, are they going to be anything better than maybe the second or third worst offensive team in the league? I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know. Actually, I mean, you think about it. I am skeptical that Okafor even is going to be able to score efficiently one-on-one. I think people who are talking about him getting a bunch of double teams this year might be a little bit ahead of where he realistically is going to be. I think teams will be content to kind of let him fire away inefficiently just one-on-one in the post. But I do think, I mean, if you got Kanan and Stauskas and Covington as your starting perimeter guys, that's three, like, legitimate three-point threats. Now, they don't really have anyone who can penetrate that well, but, you know, think of how many, if you think around the league, how many teams that have three 40% type shooters from three actually are that bad offensively? Now, you know, those guys don't have experience, they don't have people who can penetrate, blah, 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 but I think there's a slight chance they could be a little bit better than people think. What do you think of that theory?
No, I think I certainly, if Okafor is able to, you know, be efficient offensively and draw double teams, then I see those three shooters, and I think, yeah, they could probably surprise some teams offensively. You know, but if there's nobody that's going to command a double team and get them open looks, then I wonder, you know, again, they might be mid-20s offensively, but I don't think they're going to be a top half of the team on offense, or top half.
Oh,
of the
yeah. Yeah, that's...
I think a lot of it does ride on Okafor and whether or not he's able to really create for others and use that passing, which I thought was, you know, probably an underrated aspect of his game, and really what separated him as a post scorer to me was that passing and ability to read a defense, react to a double team, and get open looks for his teammates because of that. If he's able to use that, then yeah, I think there's a, you know, pretty decent upside for this team offensively, relatively speaking, of course. But if not, I could still see them being, you know, a bottom five-ish offensive team. You know, I think there's just nobody that can really create looks for anybody else.
Yeah, and we'll see. They could well be 30th again. They probably still have less offensive talent than nearly any other team in the league, barring injuries. But
I don't expect history to be set. So
yeah,
that's progress for me.
Yeah, they could just be the worst team in the league instead of, you know, the worst team this decade. So that is progress, I guess. But defensively, I'm kind of thinking, you know, Kanan, not really much of a defender. Stauskas, certainly like one of the worst in the league at shooting guard until proven otherwise. Covington, you're talking about him as kind of being okay. Noel obviously is pretty good, but and Okafor as a rookie center, I mean, I think he can ultimately be better than people think, but not really, you know, going to be at an above average level this year. I could see them taking a bit of a step back defensively this year.
Yeah, no, I think it's very possible. And again, they have a lot of athletes still coming off the bench, the Jeremy Grants, the Rashawn Holmes, you know, a lot of guys, Jakarr Sampson, if he doesn't start, a lot of guys who can play defense there. So when you look at their depth, there's some hope that they can maintain a high level of defensive play. But, I mean, that starting lineup is going to struggle. And you almost wonder if they're going to break up that starting lineup. I mean, so far, obviously Nick Stauskas is out, but they've been starting Jakarr Sampson at shooting guard. And I think a big reason for that is because of the defense he provides and the fact that you're not really getting it from very many other places in that starting lineup. So it'll be interesting. It's, like I said, if they can keep up in the top 10 range of defense with this collection of starters, then Brett Brown and Nerlens Noel deserve a heck of a lot of credit, because that's really the identity that they built. That's what Brett Brown has talked about for the past 2+ years. That's what he's stressed from day one. And I do think that there's a very real chance that they take a step back in that regard.
Yeah, and we talked about strengths. I think coaching is a strength for this team. I've been impressed with what Bron has been able to do with a bunch of guys who, you know, people talk about the Sixers as this toxic situation and no one wants to go there, and there are all these guys on kind of make good rookie contracts who could just be gone tomorrow with trader Sam Hinkie, yet he's gotten these guys to buy in and play hard and defend.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, this team has always played hard, and it's been pretty remarkable when you consider, like you said, what everyone kind of expects when a team loses at the magnitude that the Sixers do. There has been no real effort, and it's probably easier because so many of these guys are young players who aren't proven in the league, a lot of them who don't have any guarantee. So getting them to play hard and really fight for their lives probably isn't all that, you know, as difficult as it would be on a more veteran team. But, I mean, it's you know, these guys are human. I mean, this is an 82-game season. They came out last year. They lost 17 in a row, and on that 18th day, they came out and they fought. And that's, you know, you got to give Brett Brown huge credit for that. But from a scheme standpoint, too, I mean, they're a team, you know, if you go to Nylon Calculus and look at expected effective field goal percentage, they were third in the league, which is pretty incredible. Now, granted, some of that's because, you know, defenses are more than willing to let guys like, you know, Tony Roten and Michael Carter-Williams shoot from the perimeter. But, I mean, they got shots where they wanted to get shots. They just don't have the talent to convert those.
Yeah, the expected effective field goal percentage at Nylon Calculus is basically where are you shooting from, what's the league average on these shots,
and how
contested they are, right?
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, if they had guys who were pretty good, then maybe they'd be making those shots a lot more, and they're obviously going for the analytic approach of shooting as many threes. On the other hand, you could also argue that if those guys could actually hit those shots, they wouldn't be left open, but then that would open up other areas as well.
By the same token, you know, if there was any reason to double-team anybody, then guys like Hollis Thompson and Robert Covington and Isaiah Cannon would get more open looks too. So I think there's a give and take both ways. Certainly, I think there's some noise in that stat, but I do think that they ran a pretty efficient offense considering they had absolutely no offensive talent, or at least had no offensive talent last season.
What are you looking at as the key questions throughout the year, key storylines that you're going to be following for this team?
Well, I mean, the key storyline is one that probably isn't going to be resolved by the time that they're done playing, and that's Joel Embiid. I mean, that's just, you know, when I look at the guys that they've drafted, and I look at Nerlens Noel, and I look at Jahlil Okafor, and even going back to Michael Carter-Williams, they all had, yeah, he'll be a superstar if, or he'll be a really good player if. I mean, Joel Embiid was that guy who, if he's healthy, which in and of itself is an if, but if he's healthy, I have very little doubt about him being a top 20 player in the NBA. I mean, he's just that good. His game is that well-rounded, that diversified. Obviously, this is a huge question mark. And if the Sixers are going to kind of jumpstart this rebuild and exceed everyone's expectations, I do think he has to be a part of that. So it's going to be fascinating to watch, you know, him come back. And all the guys that, it seems like there's a lot of optimism with regard to the bone graft and giving him a chance to play. Obviously, the one you look at is Ilgauskas, and the troubles he went through in the first 3 years of his career to come back and have, you know, 10 pretty healthy seasons after that. But, I mean, there's so many so many examples on the other end of that spectrum that it's you know, everyone's going to be nervous until he actually is able to get back on the court, and even then they're going to be nervous for years afterwards. So that'll be fun to watch. Whether or not there's a trade deadline.
Well, so yeah, can I let's talk a little bit more about Embiid before you move on, because the timeline of sort of how this all happened was a little bit confusing to me. And I will say I'm still optimistic for him if he can get back, but also 2 years basically of missed development time. You know, you have to kind of price that into his ceiling, I think. But you know, so he comes back. He's doing all this stuff where he's playing. I think he was even playing one-on-one. There's, yep, like, I forget where it came from, but he supposedly was, like, you know, kicking Noel's ass in practice or something. Am I misremembering that,
nope,
or is that...
Nope, that happened.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then all of a sudden, the healing isn't going as well as we had hoped. It was never clear to me whether there was a re-break, whether if the healing wasn't going as well as they had hoped, why was he out there doing competitive basketball activities? Can you shed some light on that at all? That, because it's, it doesn't quite add up to me, but maybe I'm missing part of the story.
No, it doesn't quite add up, because if they're going to let him out there, and at, you know, by the time that they had found the setback, he was pretty much playing organized basketball with the team. I mean, it wasn't organized in the setting that coaches and all that were around, but I mean, the players were out at their training facility, and he was playing and wowing everybody. So in order for him to have the go-ahead to do that, you have to assume that it was healed. Not that it was healing, that it was healed. And they were
right,
comfortable with where it was at. So for them to then go back and have, you know, the next MRI and for something to be wrong, then something had to have changed. You have to almost look at that as not just something that stopped healing, but there almost had to have been a setback. It was never fully explained. All Sam Hinkie and everybody ever said was that there was less healing than expected, that it didn't look right, but they never got into the details of whether or not it was rebroken, whether or not it was... He did say it was at the same spot, but never full details on what exactly is wrong in his foot.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's one of two things, right? Either they messed up and didn't figure out that the healing was never as good as anticipated and they let him out there, or he broke it again.
Right.
I mean, it's got to be one of those two things.
It does seem like it would fall into one of those two buckets, yeah.
What was he doing in practice that everyone was so excited about?
Well, I think a lot of it was the one-on-one with Noel. I think they were,
yeah,
they were playing, and like you said, he was. It seemed like he was asserting himself pretty well. I mean, but he was a guy, even when he was just warming up in warm-up lines, you know, you could see his athleticism and the fluidity for a guy of his size, not just his height, you know, but his size and strength. And he's a guy who, you know, he sent a text to Brett Brown, and he basically said, "Hey, Brett, guess my height." And, you know, Brett's like, "Well, you're 7 foot. You're just measured at the combine." He's like, "No, I'm 7'2". So, I mean, he's a guy who may or may not still be growing. And that drives me nuts, by the way. It would be really nice if the NBA officially measured these guys throughout their career so we could kind of see the changes.
You and Ethan Strauss are the two proponents of that. But, yeah.
It would be interesting to see whether guys actually do grow as they age into their early 20s. But, you know, he was a guy who was looking really good at pretty much everything he did. He was a guy who was out of shape, you know, in the fall, back in December area. There were some rumblings that he was out of shape, you know, but he had worked all that off. And he was in good shape. He was shooting well from the perimeter. He was rolling the basket. He was looking really good in everything he did. And then you know, the worst possible news. I mean, that news came out, what, maybe 3 weeks before he was, 2 weeks before he was supposed to play in a summer league. I mean, it was a huge blow for everybody involved.
So I interrupted you with some of the questions you're going to be following. I think you started to mention, you know, whether there are going to be any trades.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. If, you know, they have so many assets right now. And I think one of the strategies that they're taking with this rebuild is they don't want to rely on any one pick or any one guy to really be the one that's going to save them. So I think that's why you're seeing trades like the Lakers trade or the pick of Michael Carter Williams for the Lakers pick, like you're seeing with Sacramento Kings for the pick swaps and the 2019 first round pick. You know, they're collecting a lot of these assets. And I think eventually what you're going to see is they're going to make a trade. One of these guys, one of these superstars who are, you know, maybe not all that happy with their current situation, they're going to push some of their chips in and acquire them. So I think it's going to be really interesting to watch, whether that's at the deadline, whether that's next offseason, whether that's, you know, a year and a half from now, I don't know. But I do think there's a non-zero chance, you know, that they could maybe hit the fast-forward button on this rebuild. Not because they're getting impatient, but because one of these guys, whether that's, you know, Okafor maybe looking better than expected early on, or Noel taking the next step, or maybe that's next fall, Embiid actually being able to play. I think eventually they're going to get one of these guys that are going to be worthy of being built around. And they're going to use some of these future draft picks and assets and front court glut and maybe, you know, finally doing what people would call building a team. So I think just the team building aspect, I think, is going to be fun to watch, you know, throughout the season and in the next offseason.
Yeah, I think so. And they're obviously they're going to have as much cap space as they want any of these years going forward. The number one kind of need on this team to me is a, you know, great solution at point guard. The point guard free agent market does not look great this year, looks much better in 2017. So maybe if they can get to the point where they're starting to look viable, that's when they could strike in 2017. And obviously, you know, a guy who can create on the wing as a two-way guy is another one that would be. But those guys, you know, I mean, I think like a Jaylen Brown in this draft is someone who I think would fit in really well with what they want to do.
Yeah, no, I mean, next draft, I mean, they've got their own pick, which should be top five. They've got the Lakers pick who, you know, I think the Lakers are going to be in the top half of the lottery probably. You know,
that's only top three protected this year and same for next year.
Yep.
And then unprotected in 2018.
And then they had the Kings pick swap. And, you know, I mean, the Kings shouldn't be bad enough where it comes into play. But, I mean, even if the Sixers end up with the third worst record and the Kings end up with the sixth worst record, I think there's like a 14% chance that after the lottery, it ends up benefiting the Sixers. So, again, that's something that you have to keep an eye on. And obviously the Kings have a little bit of combustibility with them. I mean,
sure.
You have, you know, the Carl Cousins relationship, and then you had, you know, today Rondo. And I'm not entirely sure if Rondo was serious when he said this, but he basically said that his relationship with Carl isn't going well. So you have a lot of strong personalities on this team, or on that team. And any one of those combusting at the wrong time, you could have an unexpected finish for the Kings, and the Sixers could benefit from that. And again, they don't have to benefit this year. They don't have to benefit next year. But they also have that pick, which is top 10 protected in 2018, which could then become unprotected in 2019. So there's a lot of avenues. Next draft is going to be fascinating. There's so many guys at the top of that draft who I think are interesting.
Yeah, Ben Simmons is another guy
Ben
who I
Simmons,
think
Scal.
Could really help them as well. Yeah,
yeah. No, there's. I mean, it'll be interesting if Scal, Labossiere, probably Labossiere, it's French. But it'll be really interesting if he separates himself as the best prospect and the Sixers are in a position to draft him. Because at some point...
Yeah, it's like 8 million centers now.
Right, but I mean, if you're in a Sixers position, can you not take a guy who's clearly the best prospect? So it'll... It's kind of what the team went through with Okafor this year, really what they went through to a point with Embiid last year, and they could be in the same position again. So it'll be fascinating, but they should have a lot of opportunities this offseason.
Yeah, and they have other draft assets as well. They have Oklahoma City's pick this year, which is lottery protected, but then they can also swap it with Golden State if Golden State finishes with a worse record than Oklahoma City. They have a pick from Miami that is top 10 protected this year and unprotected next year. And what else do they have? They have... No, that's about it.
That's,
okay.
That's it.
And they have the pick swaps, and then they have a treasure trove of second-rounders as well through all these kind of salary dump transactions. So, all right, we've made it this far. Give me your prediction for the Sixers this year, predicted record.
I would probably say about 25 wins. I do think there will be a slight improvement. I do worry about that defensive identity that they built. But like you said, I do expect them to be better offensively. Now, you know, how far up the rankings that goes, I'm not entirely sure. But they should be more competent. And I think that's going to be big. And I think just having these guys around Brown and in the NBA for another season, especially a guy like Noel, I think is going to do a lot. I would say about 25 wins is my prediction.
Yeah, that is fairly optimistic. I think their over-under is, I can't remember if it was 21 or 21.5.
I think it's 21.5.
Yeah, so you are over that. Welcome to the crowd. Everyone who has come on the podcast, except for one, I think has picked their teams over. So that'd be interesting. Yeah, I mean, they're 18-64 a year ago, which was right at their Pythagorean record, you know, what you would have expected based on their point differential. I can't say that I am quite that optimistic. I think that they'll probably maybe get to like 20 wins. I expect that the defense, if they're going to be playing Stauskas, Kanan, and Okafor all together in big minutes, that there's just no way it can be as good as it was last year. Maybe I'm underselling Noel because he is unbelievable, and I think especially with another year of experience, he'll just make this team awesome on its own. And they do have all those athletes, so if Brown can work those guys in a little bit more, then maybe that is possible, and you know maybe they get up to like 28th or something in offense. So what do you see as like the absolute best case scenario for this group? Because I frankly would have thought that was like 25 wins, but I'm guessing if that's your prediction, you see it as maybe even potentially higher than that.
I wouldn't go too much higher than that. I mean, absolute best case is probably 27 to 30. So I think they're probably towards the upper end of their expected one loss. I would say my prediction probably is. But I do think it's, you know, winning less than, say, 18 games in this league is very, very difficult. It's just, if you come out and play hard every night, I think part of my prediction is probably because I've seen them come out and give effort every night. And I think the last 2 years, my prediction before the season would have taken the under. In fact, I'm pretty sure I did take the under. And I think I've just learned that he's going to get their effort so consistently high that they're not going to lose as much as we expect. And I think that is probably a big reason I think they're going to, you know, hit the upper end of maybe the expected range.
Yeah, last year I think their over-under was like 15.5, and I actually thought it would go under because just looking at their roster, they had one player in Noel who you thought of as an established NBA talent.
Well, and then they came out and started the season 0-17, and that team that was 0-17 was honestly the worst offense I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it was bad. It was real bad. It was kind of amazing how much difference one player made, because their turnaround, quote unquote, really happened when Robert Covington started playing. And it's not so much what Covington can do, but just the fact that you had one legitimate shooter and how much that just opens things up. I mean, they had no spacing whatsoever to start the year. It was really brutal.
Yeah, and that's really no longer the case now with Kanan. Nick Stauskas is going to play Covington. Some of these athletes will probably, you know, having another year to kind of work on things a little bit. So, you know, they should have something more resembling a real NBA offense. I mean, they just, you know, until Roten comes back, they don't really have anyone who I think can get to the basket off the dribble at all. So I guess you see their worst case as kind of being like, you know, 19-21, something around there.
Yeah, probably in that range.
All right, so this is going to be a really interesting question. I'll get you out of here after this one, but what would your grade be for the team's ownership and front office management team, basically since Hinkie came into power, which was what? That was like June of 2013? Yeah, right before the 2013 draft.
You know, I probably look at this a lot differently than a lot of people do. And I at least can fall back on, you know, I basically wrote that they should blow everything up and build through the draft, basically because free agency is so stacked against teams that don't have a superstar. You know, in order to really attract a top 20 player in this league, you pretty much need to have a top 20 player on roster. And if you don't, then free agency is kind of a waste of time. So I do believe in what they're doing. I do believe that you need to get your first great player in the draft. And I think how I grade them, first of all, for ownership, you know, I almost have to grade ownership as an A because they're letting this process play out.
I totally agree with you. I mean, when you look at what their TV ratings are, like, embarrassing. There's like less than 30,000 people watching each game or something like that. Like, it's just, and they really are getting just criticized left and right. Everyone thinks, you know, in the mainstream media thinks of this team as a joke. What are they doing? It's ridiculous. And I think the fact that they're committing to that strategy is unbelievable, frankly. I think, like, any, if you asked any GM in the league, I think, you know, what ownership would you want to be working for? I think that they would be in the top five.
Yeah. I mean, it's the way something like this falls flat on its face is if you shortcut it and you say, you know, 2 years in, I just don't have the stomach for this. I can't take this. Like, we've got to start winning now. And they might not have the pieces, you know, to really go out and win now. And they might then undercut their ability to draft the pieces that they really need. So I think they have given Hinkie the flexibility and the freedom that if, you know, we can debate the merits of the strategy all we want, but if the strategy is going to work, they've given him what he needs from them. So I can't fault them at all. Now for Hinkie, I grade him almost entirely on whether or not, you know, you can only do so much in the draft. And you can only control ping pong balls so much, and you can only control who comes out and who's available. The way I grade him is what opportunity have they missed? And, you know, it's hard for me to really criticize any of their draft picks. Getting Noel at 6 was huge. They didn't miss on anyone in the Joel. I mean, and again, I wrote before the draft that I would have taken Joel Embiid number 1 even with the injury. I was that confident in his ability. Looking at who was left after Wiggins and Parker were on the board, I can't fault that pick. Because, again, I don't see anyone behind them that they missed on that's going to be a superstar. And the same thing with this draft. You know, I had both Karl Anthony Towns and Russell rated above Okafor, but I mean, they weren't in that spot. So I basically grade him on opportunity cost and whether or not they've missed out on a superstar. And with the exception, you know, of real Giannis and whatnot in the Michael Carter-Williams draft and Gobert and the Michael Carter-Williams draft, they really haven't missed on their picks. Even if they haven't worked out, they haven't missed anybody that would have really altered the course of the franchise.
So yeah, and even Carter-Williams was a good pick. Right. I mean, they when ended you consider up getting how terrible that draft was. The guy won Rookie of the Year. He's not that great, but he's a starting point guard in the NBA. Right. At 11, that's a totally fine
how
pick.
Many picks around the 10 through 14 range, you know, 4 years down the line, you have nothing to show for it. Well, the Sixers have a potential, you know, top five, top seven pick to show for Michael Carter-Williams still. And, you know, like I said earlier, that's not always, you know, a lot of times you'll get, yeah, well, you have to draft that player, you have to develop him, that's going to be 4 years until they help. Well, that could also be a trade chip, too. So, I can't even really fault them for that, even if maybe Giannis or Gobert would be a better long-term piece. So then I go off.
Yeah, nobody was talking about Gobert in that range. I think, you know, it always puzzled me why they weren't, frankly, because I thought he was really good. But, you know, it's not realistic to say you should have drafted a guy who went 27th with the 11th pick. Like, that's just not how it works.
Right, exactly. So then I go to kind of like second level stuff. I look at the Jrue Holiday trade, which basically turned into Nerlens Noel and, you know, two picks, two probable lottery picks. One of those Dario Saric, and they end up getting one of their own picks back. That's a great trade to me. I mean,
yeah, that was awesome when they just put the Magic in jail like that.
Right. I mean, you look at the crazy, and this is how injuries in the NBA are crazy. You know, since that trade, Nerlens Noel has played more games than Jrue Holiday, and he's probably provided more value than Jrue Holiday. And I would say over the next 5 years, he's going to provide more value than Jrue Holiday. So that was a great trade and a great way to capitalize on that opportunity. And then you look at, you know, the Stauskas trade, and again, I'm a big believer in giving yourselves options to acquire a great player. So you have those two pick swaps and a future pick, and that's even disregarding the, you know, guy who was selected 8th overall in the last draft. That to me was a great trade. So I'm looking at some of these smaller trades, and I have to agree largely with what they're doing. It would be nice if they went out and maybe a little more aggressive for a point guard. Or even really any kind of a perimeter player who could create offense, use some of that cap space. But by the same token, I know that, you know, their rebuild right now is entirely dependent on whether or not they're able to acquire a great player. And I think the best way to do that is through the draft, and I can't really disagree with what they've done. So I'd probably, if I were being fair, I'd probably go B+.
Yeah, the only thing that they have done on an individual move standpoint that I disagreed with a little bit, and this is really nitpicking, was to say maybe they should have tried to get a couple more guys in last year, because you remember the year before they actually had guys like Hawes, Turner, who were at least real NBA players, last year to just give these guys a way to develop in just something that kind of mimics what real NBA life actually is.
Right.
Now, you know, especially Noel, and I was like, all right, you know, Noel is not doing what I think he's ultimately going to be doing. On the other hand, though, you can say, hey, he actually has looked pretty good off the dribble. He's, you know, why not just let him stretch his wings a little bit? And, you know, maybe it doesn't work out, but that's like another way of developing players that we really haven't seen very much in the NBA, to kind of let guys, you know, do more than their talent really allows, but hope that they grow into the role. So that's a small nitpick. I mean, but yeah, I mean, all of the little transactions, I mean, I thought the Kings trade was obviously an excellent one. I think that Michael Carter Williams, especially when you look at how he has looked with the Bucks and just his lack of shooting, just has enough limited upside that for where they were, and he's also older than you think as well. I mean, I think he was like 21 when he was drafted. So, you know, and they were going to have to pay him relatively soon. I thought that that made sense. You just, it's all about just giving yourself as many lottery tickets as you can. The slogan is trust the process. I think the process has been great. Now the results, you can argue, they've probably been pretty unlucky. I mean, they granted the Embiid thing, that was a known risk. It hasn't worked out, at least for 1 year and now for 2 years, but that's gone absolutely as unluckily as you could have expected at the time, with him now going to miss 2 years in a row, even though it was a possibility. I mean, then they haven't gotten even a top two pick, despite having the worst record, essentially. Well, I guess they didn't have the worst record. They're number two both years, but or I guess they're only three, last year. So I guess that actually they ended up right about where they should have been last year. But, you know, they haven't gotten super lucky in the draft to get into the top two. So that's another thing that you could look at. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that I would even give them an A-, but also when you do that, you do have to say, look, this has been 2 years of misery for the fans. You can't forget that. It does have value to be, you know, an eighth seed type of team instead of just being terrible. But what it ultimately comes down to is he's doing what the ownership wants. Like, that is your job as the GM, is to accomplish the goals of your ownership, and the ownership wants to build a consistent contender that's going to have championship upside. And if that is the goal, I think every decision pretty much that they've done has maximized those chances.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I mean, there are certainly people who... It's basically how much better of a chance you have of being great to justify years of being awful. And I'm pretty hard set in the, if you're not a realistic championship contender, then you're wasting your time. But I also understand people who just want to go and see a competitive baseball game or basketball game, who just want to go and see, you know, a playoff series and who want to be entertained. I understand that as well. And I can't tell you how to root for your team. And I don't think any way of rooting for them is right or wrong. I do think that, you know, a team's ultimate goal is to win a championship. And I think what they're doing, for where they were after the Andrew Bynum trade, I think is the right way to go about it. Now, you know, it's just a tough sport with the NBA. I mean, it's a league where you can pick, you know, five or six teams and have a pretty reasonable certainty that the championship is going to come from those five or six teams. And you can pick them before the season starts. And rarely is that wrong. And it's so different than what, say, football is and Philadelphia. And I think part of the reason that, you know, there's a split among Sixers fans is because Philadelphia is such a big football town. And in football, you have those non-guaranteed contracts. You have, you know, only 16 games and only four games in the playoffs. And you can get on a hot run and exceed your expectations and get a couple lucky bounces of the ball and win a championship, or at least rebuild and be back in contention real quickly. Whereas the NBA is pretty much the exact opposite of that. And it's set up for dynasties, and it's set up to be hard to become elite. So it's a lot of, you know, are you willing to go through this for a percent chance of being great? And I understand both sides of the argument, but by the same token, Philadelphia hasn't won an NBA championship since 1983, and it would be a great thing to see.
Yeah, I like what they're doing, and I think had I been brought in and had the freedom, I would have proceeded in a pretty similar way. I guess the other criticism that you could point to also is perception in the NBA means something. If you want to get free agents, if you want players to be happy there. And their perception, rightly or wrongly, I think maybe wrongly, is just at an all-time low. And I think most players just don't want to go there. Now, if they overpay them, if they start to look better with some of the young talent, maybe that changes. But right now, I think a lot of players are just, you know, want absolutely nothing to do with Philadelphia. I mean, and I think, you know, I don't think that they've treated guys wrong. You know, I talked to Jason Thompson, who's with the Warriors at Media Day. I asked him, you know, what was your communication with Sam? And he said, you know, it was good that I was happy to come home, but they're honest with me about where they were. You know, they treated me well. So, you know, I don't think there have been some bad optics things, like that story that came out with Kirilenko about, like, not communicating with him and refusing to release him and stuff. But in large part, you know, I don't know if they deserve blame for that, but when you're bad for a long time and you're viewed as tanking, it's just something that's going to happen.
Yeah. No, and I mean, they've been pretty open, like you said, to their players. And they'll tell them, they'll like, look, we don't know if you're going to be a part of what we're doing a year from now. We don't know. You know, if you're going to be on the roster a month from now, he's like, the only thing we can guarantee you is that when you're here, we're going to do everything we can, you know, to make you the best version of you that we can. And I think a lot of, especially the younger guys, appreciate that. And it's, you know, I think camaraderie and morale in a clubhouse is pretty strong. Certainly outside of the team, there's a perception problem. And the team doesn't really do a whole lot to go out of their way to change that. But I don't think they really care all that much either, to be honest. I do think they believe that if they start winning, then perception is fickle and players will want to play and national media will like them again. I mean, you look at what, and everyone goes to, you know, Seattle, Oklahoma City, because it's really the only one that's even remotely similar to what they're doing, even though it's, you know, you can't expect that level of success. But I mean, yeah. Perception turned around awfully quickly there. So it's an entirely results-based business. If they do hit, if Okafor turns out to be who, you know, a lot of people think he could be, or at least thought he could be, if Embiid somehow comes back, if they hit in the 2016 draft, you know, I think perception will turn around, and I'm not sure they're really interested in drawing high-level free agents at this point anyway. So the perception right now, as long as it's not a long-term perception problem, I don't think they're all that concerned about it.
Yeah, and they're going to be bringing Saric over hopefully next year as well. Yeah, real quickly, if you got time, you know, because you obviously do draft stuff too. What do you think of Saric and his progress and what he can maybe contribute to this team in the long term?
Well, I think you have to say that he exceeded pretty much all expectations last year when he went to Turkey. I mean, that was a step up in competition. That was a much harder league that he played in, and he played very well. And he made some progress, especially in the second half of the season, on his perimeter shot, which is going to be key for him. You know, he's such a good decision maker with the ball, and he's so creative with the ball that if he's able to have defenders guarding him, you know, 20 feet from the basket, it's going to benefit him tremendously. And I think that's going to be a key skill for him, and I think he improved in that regard. I mean, he was on fire to end the season. Scoring, shooting, rebounding, pushing the ball in transition, just such a unique player for a 6'10" big man. I'm not entirely sure how he translates as a defender in the NBA. And I think that, along with his you know, perimeter shot, is probably going to be what determines whether or not he's just a piece or a good player or a very good player. I think those two attributes are key for him. But I do think he's going to be a player in the NBA. I mean, he's got so much creativity from a spot that really doesn't have a whole lot of creativity that he's going to be a fun guy to watch. And he's going to be a fun guy to fit in with, you know, the bigs that they've currently assembled. You know,
so you're thinking of him as a big then?
I think of him.
You think is that how they think of him, as a four rather than a three?
Maybe.
I think offensively, that's absolutely the case. He's better as a four.
Yeah, and I think defensively, I mean, the one thing that he can definitely do on the defensive side of the court is rebound the ball, and then push the ball in transition when he does get it.
Yeah, he's awesome at that. Like, he is some of the Euro steps that he had in Eurobasket in transition were awesome.
Yeah. I mean, personally, from my own perspective and philosophy, I'm not a big fan of big fours that can't defend threes and putting them on the perimeter. So you combine that with his defensive rebounding and pushing the ball in transition. I want him as close to the basket as I can. But the Sixers have such a glut right now that they'll probably experiment with him at the three some.
Yeah. And he will, one thing that he will be able to do from the three, is post up because he is really tough. He will just put guys in the goal, and he's got a nice game with his hook shots and stuff. So
he's also
he'll be
a
able
really
to
good passer out of the post, too.
Yeah, so. Right. Yeah, all right. I've kept you for far too long. Where can we follow you on Twitter and anything you've written lately that we should be checking out?
I mean, easiest way is Twitter, at Derek Bodner NBA. Just go there. If anything cross you find interesting, then go for it. If not, all good. but like you said, I mean, there's enough non-Sixers content as well that it's a fun time. It's I think honestly being so heavily involved in the draft makes this process probably easier for me. But it's fascinating. I mean, when Brett Brown took the job, he called it a big science experiment, and it's pretty much been that because they throw a lot of conventions to the wind, and they have a very distinct way of doing things.
Yeah, and the nice thing too is that this year with Okafor and some of the shooters they have, I think they'll actually be watchable, which will be nice. You know, I definitely am going to be watching them a lot more closely just from out of my own curiosity. So that'll be great. And obviously you do the mock drafts on USA Today as well. Do you do those throughout the season or you kind of wait until...
We'll probably pick that up. I would guess about the time that conference play starts. There's a lot, I think, noise in the beginning part of the season. With college basketball. So I would guess it will probably kickstart that, you know, early part of 2016.
Awesome. All right, so definitely check that out. And for us, you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Also supporting the podcast, just using the Capspace code on SeatGeek or DraftKings. That's all one word, Capspace, and easy to remember because we talk about Capspace a lot on this podcast. So that's another great way to support the podcast. As for my writing, my Facebook page is Nate Duncan NBA. I wrote a piece on the four players that I'm most looking forward to seeing on the Cauldron, which you should definitely check out at SI.com, and also with some random preseason observations from all the games I've been watching. And that'll do it for today. So thanks so much for Derek coming on, and we will talk to y'all next time.
My pleasure.